Hello and welcome to AUP Radio, a melting pot of voices and ideas, brought to you by World Radio Paris. Today we have two shows coming up. We'll start off with Albums Without Borders and then move on to Resident Geeks. Enjoy!
Welcome back to AUP Radio. This is Albums Without Border. I am George, and I'm here with my co-host, Andrew. Say hi, Andrew.
Hi, George.
Hi. Today we are going to be discussing Coming Home by Leon Bridges. It is a neo-soul R&B album that was released in 2015. But before we do that, you've been listening to any new music last week? Or we had break, too, so we had like a... about 2 weeks since our last podcast.
Yeah, maybe we should catch up on what we've been listening to, just individually. That's not explicitly the album that we're covering.
Yeah,
I've been listening to a lot of Fountains of Wayne.
Of course, you have.
As you know,
mm-hmm.
I think we socialize too much as coworkers outside of the studio.
Mm-hmm. I need to get away from you more.
I feel like we should cut down on that. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree.
And I've been listening to a bunch of music from movies that I've been watching lately.
Oh, yeah? Soundtracks or, like, just songs that are... scores or soundtracks?
I would say that most of them are soundtrack songs. Cool. that are just included. And I've been listening to a little Bob Dylan, like always.
Mm-hmm. Old Faithful?
Yeah. Harry Nissen, George Harrison.
Okay.
A lot of George Harrison, and I'm getting really into the Beastie Boys lately, actually.
Oh, my brother loves the Beastie Boys.
I love the Beastie Boys.
Yeah, that's a really cool story, and they're ridiculously influential in music.
Yeah.
I had no idea. I kind of wrote them off as a white boy rap group, but like the Wu-Tang Clan and a lot of very well-established rappers and rap groups love the Beastie Boys, and their use of sampling is incredible. Like, they have... one song that has like more than 150 samples in it or something, just absurd. But talking about soundtracks, I watched Reservoir Dogs the other day, and I hadn't seen it. I like Tarantino movies, but for some reason I just had never sat down to watch it, and I cannot listen to that Steeler's Wheel song Stuck in the Middle with You the same way. Have you seen that movie?
Yeah.
Oh my God, it's crazy. It's such a happy song, and then he... Yeah.
There's a long story about this. There's actually an interesting story attached to it because I think Harvey Weinstein produced Reservoir Dogs and Quentin Tarantino was told to cut that scene out of the movie because without that scene, the movie is sort of like a PG-13 movie and he wanted the rating of the movie to go from an R, Harvey Weinstein, to a PG-13 rating so it would get more people to watch the movie, make more money. And then Quentin Tarantino said something like, this is, if people don't like it, then that's fine. is what I'm going to do. So, yeah.
I appreciate that.
It was his first movie. It was his first blockbuster. Yeah. Sort of like, you know, it was funded by Harvey Weinstein. So,
yeah, that's interesting. You know, retrospectively.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was his first movie. I think it debuted at Cannes Film Festival, and it won the Palme d'Or, I believe.
Did it actually? I didn't know that.
I think so. Sorry, listeners, if you're a movie buff and we're wrong, but yeah, I've been listening to a bunch of Greta Van Fleet, which again I had kind of brushed off as a Led Zeppelin cover band, which they definitely have a very, very similar sound, but that links in nicely to what we're doing today in terms of recreating old sounds with Leon Bridges. A lot of people get mad. They think it's lazy, and I think at worst it's an homage, and at best it's carrying a torch. So on that note, let's get into some Leon Bridges. Like I said, the album was released in 2015. It was his first studio album, and he managed to get the record deal because he had been doing some open mic nights. He was working as a dishwasher in Fort Worth, Texas, just outside of Dallas. And he was doing open mic nights and put some songs on SoundCloud and got some attention and some critical reception. And went to record the album at Nile City Sound, which is in Fort Worth. And the album did very well overall. It peaked at number 7, I believe, on the U.S. charts, and both U.S. and U.K. R&B charts, it peaked at number 1. There was slight criticism, like I said, about a recreation of an old sound. It does have some Sam Cooke, Otis Redding vibes, some Smokey Robinson, Nat King Cole, stuff like that. And, some music reviewers were a little, you know, upset or not upset. They said that, you know, he has a great voice, but, you know, he's yet to find his true voice on the album. What do you feel when you listen to it?
I feel so warm inside, you know. It's not exactly a winter album. You know, there's stuff that gets popular around winter that's not explicitly to do with Christmas, but still is a little bit like fuzzy, like Harry Potter movies. Or,
yeah, that's interesting.
You know, like just stuff that's related in some way, either materially or on the surface level related to Christmas and the aesthetic, because just things are cold. I think this album is, there's like a discussion to be had, like we talked about earlier, privately, about what's a tribute, what is derivative, where's the line on that, and what is original, and what's just, you know, experimentation that has gone wrong. I think that Leon Bridges.
Yeah, where do you put him? Where do you put this album? Because he's done 3.
I think that it's hard not to like him or call him derivative, because derivative is pejorative.
Yeah, it is.
Even though it might somewhat be, I think the difference between derivative and a tribute is the acknowledgement of where your sound came from. Whereas derivative gives a connotation, at least to me, that you're trying to get away with something, you know, and you're trying to get away with taking someone else's work and originality and trying to make it your own. Well, I think Leon Bridges is not the most experimental songwriter, which I don't have a problem with at all.
Not at all.
Because, as I said earlier, I've been listening to a lot of Fountains of Wayne, and the Fountains of Wayne didn't really think to expand their sound in any new direction that is so bold. You know, it's not like Star Trek. going out to where no one else has gone before.
It's true.
Leon Bridges is harder not like, at least for me, because he's just so unapologetically grateful for where his roots are, and he acknowledges where a lot of his theatrics come from, but he's just putting a new spin on it. I think all he really wants to happen is for this genre of music that he loves, soul and R&B. And not in the Amy Winehouse style, but in the style of, as you said, Otis Redding and Sam Cooke, that genre not to die. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to save it, and he's trying to reformulate it to a new generation of people. our generation of people, right? And I think a lot of the people that I know who have been listening to Leon Bridges will tell you and me that this, they don't really listen to this genre of music usually. Much in the same way that a lot of people who wouldn't usually listen to country music would listen to Tyler Childers.
Yeah. No, exactly. No, that's very true, actually. When I first got into Leon Bridges, it was when this album came out, and I heard the song River. I think it was in an Apple commercial. Then I went on to the album, and I think it was Summer Vacation, and I had plenty of time, so I just sit there and play video games listening to it or something. And I really got into it. And actually, you know, the opposite of what these music reviewers, who are obviously were significantly older than me at the time, I mean, still are. I'm not catching up to them in age. It's not how age works. But I found Leon Bridges, and that took me to Otis Redding and Sam Cooke. I think, you know, I'd heard Sitting on the Dock of the Bay and Stand By Me, Benny King. But this kind of remediation of the genre allowed younger listeners like me to get into it. But I'd say the major difference is the technology that he had access to in terms of recording. But he did try to stay true to it in the sense that a lot of modern music is recorded in parts and then spliced together, but they recorded all their all the songs on the album live. Everything was done, not necessarily in one take, but in a single take. I thought that was cool, and it adds to the raw feeling of it, the honest production of the record.
I'm sure this has been said before, but I think that when I listen to this album, in particular from his discography, I feel like it's trying to emulate, in some part, Phil Spector's Wall of Sound. It's very Wall of Soundy, which means that all the instruments sort of blend together in a way that there's no discernible individual instrument. Although you can definitely tell there's guitar and horns and drums and bass in there, but the Wall of Sound technique, which is a style of production that the Beach Boys used, and on the Christmas album, Phil Spector's Christmas album, which is my favorite Christmas album.
You have a favorite Christmas album?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, okay.
It's actually Brian Wilson's favorite album, not just
really
his favorite Christmas album, but he says that Phil Spector's Christmas album is his favorite album of all time. Great album. You should check it out. Everyone check it out, including George.
I might, but I'm scared of Christmas music in general. I worked at a grocery store, so... It might be a tough listen for me, but for you, Andrew, I'll do it.
Yeah. Okay. Just for me.
Yeah.
Just for me. It reminds me of that, and I didn't really know why or how they achieved this effect, because people partly don't use that technique that much anymore because it's not really in style. Because a lot of it has to do with the fact that our speakers are better these days.
Okay.
And the Wall of Sound was created to sound really good on bad, you know, speakers.
Okay.
That didn't really have the capability to individualize all these individual frequency categories.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just all sort of blend together, and it was to optimize how good it sounded on bad speakers.
Gotcha.
So it's not really used these days, but I think that another element of why people don't use that technique anymore is because it's just hard to do, and Phil Spector was a master at it. He's been now accused of murder. He's in jail now, but...
Really?
Yeah.
Damn. So convicted of murder?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, that was a quick turn of events.
Yeah.
Well, would you say that was that production style that he, mastered? Would you say
he's dead, actually.
Oh, he's dead. Okay. Lots going on. Would you say that was a reaction to the fact that they tried to not do that, and then they would play it through these speakers and it would come out sounding terrible, even though live it sounded great? Like, he was like, oh, we need to do something about this. And because I feel like trying to blend the music, to me, sounds like a bad idea.
I feel like...
Was it a reaction to the limitations of the technology at the time?
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
Definitely. That was the case. But also, if you were to listen to the Christmas album in particular, it doesn't hold up as well as a Wall of Sound example, simply because our AirPods allow us to distinguish between the frequencies just with so much clarity now than on a radio in the 1960s.
Right.
So it doesn't actually have the effect of the Wall of Sound, the metaphoric Wall of Sound anymore. But I definitely feel like the reason why this effect was popularized was because of the Beach Boys, because of Phil Spector's involvement with the Beach Boys.
Okay.
And how their music sounded, it just sounded all cohesive together.
Mm-hmm.
There is definitely some merit in having your harmonies just be so intertwined and emulsified and dependent on each other that it all just sounds like one giant symphony. It's sort of like when you're in a church with a lot of reverb and the choir singers are all singing the right frequency, you will hear another note on top of all these a cappella singers that no one is singing, but it's a consequence of the timbre of these frequencies being conjoined together. And a lot of that effect is achieved in the Wall of Sound, where you hear a lot of these, you know, different textures of sound that you wouldn't necessarily have when you were to have very individualized
tracks. Nobody themselves is making, but somehow combining these sounds produces something secondary.
Yeah,
that's cool. You know, maybe I hadn't given that much thought. I was unaware of this theory of the Wall of Sound, but maybe when I give it a listen through again, because I listen to this album all the time. I love this album. I have it on vinyl. I will pay attention for that.
Yeah.
For
this album came out in 2015.
Yes, 2015 indeed.
So right before the calm before the storm.
Yeah, and in terms of dealing with political issues and stuff, like you, I assume that's what you're referring to. It does not. It is very simple in its lyricism and an ode to the classics, and that's why I think when it got the critical reception that it did, in the sense of like, oh, he's not being brave enough, not making bold enough choices. I don't know what they wanted from the man, because that's what got him famous. He was doing, that's what got him attention. I shouldn't say famous. That's what got him traction on SoundCloud and at open mic nights and stuff, was the fact that that's what he was doing. He was doing, he was carrying that torch of Otis Redding and stuff and, you know, trying to relight it after many, many years in the dark. And then he releases what got him popular, what his fans wanted to hear. The album does very well, and critics are like, he's not being bold enough. And I think to that I would say that, well, what are you trying to be bold about? It's classic R&B. It's easy listening stuff. It's he's talking about, for the most part of the album, he's just talking about love. He talks about family, but mostly it's about romantic love, about, you know, romantic interests and... he talks about I'd cross the Mississippi River just to be by your side, you know, stuff like that. Very over the top, kind of 1950s style romantic gestures. And I don't think it needs to be complex. It's a time machine to a simpler time. I mean, at least sonically simpler time. You know, obviously would have faced persecution as a black man in the 60s and civil rights era, but musically a simpler time. And I think he does that very, very well, which is why the album to me is excellent.
I think what happened here is that complex lyrics comes from being specific about what you're talking about. I think a lot of the lyricism, the vivid imagery that we get from modern songs, are a consequence of people actually living their lives and writing about their own lives.
Right.
And so a lot of these like details that you find really appealing in lyrics that are narrative in some sense are a consequence of just like people writing about what they know and they know best about their lives. But Leon Bridges is trying to emulate the style of, or trying to get down to the essence of the genre that he's trying to make.
Right.
And I feel like the reason why his lyrics, as you say, are sort of simple, and simplicity is one of the strengths of the lyricism in this album, is because he couldn't really write lyrics from the perspective of a person who is living in the 1960s. And so he wrote lyrics that are universal enough, and also seems to fit within the genre that he's writing in, which is, I think the consequence of that is what you describe as being simple and effective lyricism, which I think is like he's a big fan of music, and it's great to see.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and like also If you think about it, in the fact that he is trying to capture the pure essence of that R&B soul vibe. I said neo-soul at the beginning, and it's hardly neo-soul. He doesn't, like the critical reception said, doesn't add much of his own spin to it. What were they singing about? Nobody back in the day was like, hey, Otis Redding, why aren't you more political? I'm like, what?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, Andy Kellman of AllMusic in one of his reviews says, it's all a pleasing time warp without turbulence. One with songs built more to evoke the past than to last in one's memory. So he's saying it's like, it's kind of like a one and done listen, like, oh, that was pleasant, 1960s. Oh, okay, bye. And, you know, it's, I can see that he's not trying to be mean, but immediately, like as a fan of Leon Bridges, I'm biased. Immediately, I'm like, oh, that's a little bit of a shallow take because, I don't know, the songs last in my memory. I find myself humming the tunes randomly, having not listened to the album in a while. I'll just be there and then a song will pop into my head. And I think maybe what he meant to say was...
It lacks an elan.
Right.
It lacks a certain kind of edge.
Right, yeah, exactly. It's not. It doesn't burn, and it's not like, whoa, that's deep. It's more just like, hey, fun.
Yeah.
Which is like perfectly acceptable. You're allowed to have albums that are just nice. They don't have to be challenging all the time.
Yeah. It reminds me of when professors are trying to explain a certain concept. They express it in a scholarly way with such eloquence that it lacks a certain kind of aggressive, you know, edge to it, like I said. Whereas if you hear like Lou Reed say something, like, there's a clip of Lou Reed quoting from Bertrand Russell, and he's trying to explain. He's like just high off his mind, and he's like, well, like the weak people, the smart people are always, no, it's the other way around. He's like, you know, trying to mumble his way through it.
Mm.
But, you know, I feel like Leon Bridges is a master of his craft, and more importantly, he's a master of this genre.
Mm-hmm.
And what you get from that is a person who will be so faithful to his genre that it's hard for him to be individual in his music or in a certain sense, narcissistic, you know? Mm. He's not writing about himself, really. He's writing about... He's writing from the perspective of what would a person who is in the soul mindset, a very American mindset too. This album is aggressively American.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that adds a lot of diplomacy for in terms of reworking what people perceive the American identity, the cultural identity to be.
Mm.
Because I think these days we're sort of lacking a unity as a nation.
Yeah, absolutely.
For any listeners just tuning in, you're listening to AUP Radio, brought to you by World Radio Paris. Now back to Albums Without Borders.
And as far as his band is concerned, he went out and got some pretty established musicians. Maybe not, you know, like huge band members, because again, he was his first studio album and stuff. But he had Jeff Daisy on saxophone. Do you know who Nathaniel Rateliff and the Night Sweats? You know that band?
No. Is it a backing band?
No. Nathaniel Rateliff and the Night Sweats are doing pretty well these days. They're like a Americana, upbeat kind of band, country, blues influence, but they're awesome. They do a song called Son of a Bitch that got very famous, and it's fun. I've seen them in concert in Austin City Limits, and it was wild. But anyway, he got their saxophone player, who plays a very instrumental role in the album, pun fully intended. And then they went, I'd never heard of this band. He went to a band called White Denim out of Austin. They're like an indie psych rock band. And I don't know how amicable it was, but snatched a couple of their band players. He got Austin Jenkins on guitar and Josh Block on drums. And they go on tour with him ever since. And White Denim's still a band. They just have new band members. So it was just interesting to me that these people who were established musicians before Leon Bridges got his start or had enough faith in him to jump ship. Well, I don't think Jeff Daisy jumped ship. He still plays with Nathaniel Rateliff, but, you know, to go give him their time, whether they heard some of his recordings or the record label gave them enough money, I'm not sure. But I'm glad they did, because the sound produced was one of my favorites and got me really into R&B and stuff in general. And I went and listened to a whole load of Sam Cooke, who I now love following.
Are there any other artists that are trying to explore the continuation of this genre? And I'm not going to even try to define a genre. I think you could do a better job. Soul, R&B.
I mean, I don't know. 100% there is, whether or not they have the recognition. They don't have the recognition that Leon Bridges has. Otherwise, you know, we would have heard about him. The other thing I'd have to say about that is that he kind of, I don't know if caved is the right word, but he definitely took on the critical reception that he got, because his second album was, he did try to put his own spin on things. And I mean, to his credit and the credit of the critical reviewers, the album did better in the charts. Some of the singles didn't do as well as the two or three singles, Coming Home and River and Twisted and Groovin', from Coming Home did very well as singles. But the album as a whole, it's called Good Thing, it's his second album, did better in the charts, peaked at 3, whereas Coming Home peaked at 7. But yeah, he even was quoted in an interview saying, you know, I loved my first album. This is paraphrasing. I loved my first album, but, you know, in order to keep up with the likes of Bruno Mars and people like that, I've got to change my style. I've got to do something about it and come into the modern era, which when I heard that, I was like, that's a shame. But then again, he did do well. The album's great. I don't like it as much as the first album, but it's a great album, and it still has soul and R&B in it. But it definitely has modern production, and you can hear it. Definitely worth a listen still. But yeah, you're saying, is there anybody out there carrying the torch? I don't even think he's really doing that anymore. I'm sure he'll still play some of his songs from his first album, Coming Home, at his concerts, and he doesn't, you know, dismiss the album. He still likes it, and but yeah, not that I'm aware of, but I'm sure there's plenty of people out there doing it.
This is why we are Albums Without Borders, not Artists Without Borders.
Yeah.
Because some people sell out, and now we can't do them anymore.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
But albums remain whole and untouched unless it's on streaming, and in which case it could be infinitely touched.
Yeah. No, he released a third album this year, 2021, and I have not listened to it yet, just out of fear. Although I did read, if it's bad, man, I'm going to be so upset. But I read some reviews of it, and I didn't agree with many of the reviewers on the first album, so we'll see if they're right. But
how are the reviews for the new album?
It got, like, higher rating reviews from, like, Metacritic and all those things. Or I guess Metacritic is just a compilation of reviews. But they were saying it was, you know, his most personal piece to date, and it showed his skill as a songwriter and as a musician, and showed his range. You know, I don't want to put Leon in a box, but I sure am gonna miss those types of songs that came on the Coming Home album.
Yeah. I mean, I hope it's good. I'm just scared that it sounds
right,
just based on the name.
What's the name again?
Gold Digger's Sound.
Oh, yeah. That's based on a speakeasy in L.A. that has the same name. And just by virtue of that, the fact that he's in L.A. in the production, you know, I'm just like, it's not the dishwasher.
Oh, is he going to pull an Ezra Keening?
Oh, God.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, he's a Vampire Weekend, right?
Yeah, Ezra Keening moved to California from New York. His first two albums are just about New York.
Mm.
And then he moves to California, marries Rashida Jones, and just is happy all of a sudden. And I don't like it when artists are happy.
No.
I think
Go back to your depression,
please. I would
please.
Like to be sadistic towards, you know.
Yeah.
Like Phoebe Bridgers is on.
How am I supposed to relate to happy music, Andrew?
How am I? I don't get to walk on red carpets with Irish actors, you know?
Yeah.
It's not fair. So we would like our representations or
exactly.
Know.
I want to see myself in your music. I didn't know Ezra Keening was married to Rashida Jones.
It's crazy.
Are they still married?
Yeah.
Oh.
I think so. I mean, I just claimed that Phil Spector was alive a few
minutes ago.
Yeah,
you
did.
We got to fact check this, man. He also said Appalachia last time.
I swear. I swear to God. They're still married.
They are?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what happens when you become big. You know, you want
to... Yeah, it is tough to stay true to yourself and stay true to that sound. And, you know, I guess that's not a bad thing. You want him to be producing... his experiences is true, and if he lives in LA now, I don't know, it's just a shame. It's just a shame because, like, I'm saying this before I've even heard the album, I'm dismissing it. I should give it a chance, but yes, it's happened many times where I find an artist and I really, really enjoy their stuff, and then they release a second, third, fourth album, and I just slowly drift apart from it.
Yeah.
And start to not relate to it sonically or lyrically as much.
I think a lot of it, we got to blame it on the studios, not the individual artists. I'm sure that, you know, like Leon Bridges and Phoebe Bridgers don't necessarily want to have all this press going on.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to put on like 2 pounds of makeup every time they step in front of a camera.
Yeah.
It's just the studios require it. And also,
yeah.
I think they require them to adapt and overcome into new genres.
Yeah, there's always going to be someone there, a producer of some sort, telling them how to play certain songs, to change it into something poppier, to add a layer. You said that something like that happened on Phoebe Bridgers' album. The one song that didn't sound like the rest of the album.
Kyoto?
Yeah, yeah. You said that the producer told her to make it more poppy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, they are definitely under the influence of I guess, at its essence, capitalism. They're like, this is how we make more money, so please do that. So we can have cars and stuff.
This is the most we've bashed on artists yet.
Yeah, I know. But I love Leon Bridges. I don't know. I'm mad at capitalism, not you, Leon Bridges.
He's got everything. He's got a respectable cowboy hat collection.
Oh, he does. Indeed.
Like the skin of a Greek god.
Mm-hmm.
and the voice of Otis Redding. He can take this. He can take maybe one of our 7 viewers might go.
Mm.
And
I had tickets to see him a few years ago in DC, and I bought 2 tickets, and I was going to go with my girlfriend at the time, and woe is me, she broke up with me, so I was like, oh, I can't go, I don't want to go by myself. I sold my tickets, and I was bummed because I really wanted to see him, I loved him, but then I was visiting my friend in London in the summer before I was going back to DC, and there was a music festival that he was going to with his friends, and Leon Bridges was one of the main acts, and I bought the ticket literally just to see him. Like, I think it was £50, which for a concert ticket, not that bad, and there were other bands there anyway, some people that I'd never heard of before but got into. Who's that guy who sings Power Over Me? Dermot Kennedy? Yeah, that's him. He was there. That was awesome. But anyway, Leon Bridges was on at the same time as Tame Impala, and all my friend Callum and all his friends were like huge Tame Impala fans, and I had gotten into them a little bit at the time, but not hugely. I still think they're good, but I'm not a stan, as they say. But they all went to see Tame Impala, and I was by myself, pretty drunk, at Leon Bridges. And they were like, you're okay here? And I was like, I am great here. This is fantastic. And I was pretty far away, but just yelling every lyric. And the people around me were like, damn, this man loves Leon Bridges. Like, loves him. And I was like, damn right I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this goes deep.
Yeah. Know? No, I really, really enjoy his music. And his second album I know very well, but not as well as his first.
Is mainly your love stemming from Coming Home?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just like easy listening. I can put it on pretty much whenever. Apart from the gym.
Yeah.
But I don't go to the gym anymore, so it's fine.
Welcome to Paris.
Yeah, exactly. It's okay. I walk. That's what I tell myself.
Yeah, that's what I tell myself too.
Yeah, get my steps in. We'll be all right.
Yeah.
But no, a lyrically simple album, ode to the 1950s, makes you feel like you're in a low lit jazz lounge at times, having a crisp cold beer.
I imagine a bourbon actually.
Oh really?
A bourbon? I don't think this is a beer album.
No.
I think this is.
Maybe I just, you know, want a beer right now.
Maybe it's the time has come.
Yeah.
This album definitely has a mood attached to it.
For sure.
There's a vision that has been achieved.
Yeah.
At least.
No, absolutely. It's got some continuity and it's just, you can always go back to it. It's reliable.
Yeah.
I think that's all we got to say
about sturdy.
This album this week. But if you haven't heard the album, if you've only heard River, because I'm sure all of you have heard River at some point or another. If you haven't, if you think you haven't heard River, you probably have. Trust me, go listen to it. You'll be like, yes, I know this song. Check out the album and his other works and do some compare and contrast and see if you agree. And Andrew and I will get to work on a project for next week.
All right. We'll be back. We'll be back soon enough.
All right. See you later.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to AUP Radio, brought to you by World Radio Paris. Next up is Resident Geeks. Enjoy!
Welcome to Resident Geeks, a radio show discussing the Resident Evil franchise, movies, live adaptations, animated, video games, comics, and TV shows. I am Rachel here with AUP Radio. You want it, we'll try to make it happen. Thank you for joining us tonight. We all know that there is no shortage in material whenever it comes to Resident Evil. I mean, for crying out loud, you can spend hours on extremely minor details. Yet, my creative self could not muster anything. It was coming up with zero. So I was thinking about it. Barry's iconic Jill sandwich line popped up. And I just thought, who doesn't miss good old Barry Burton? Definitely the dad group of the Alpha Team, if not the entire STARS department. He is definitely one of my favorite characters, and I am glad he got his time to shine in Revelations 2. I know Barry has done a lot throughout the entire timeline, but I really want to focus on his particular timeline as it pertains to Revelations 2. I know it's not a main game, but I really enjoyed it. And visually, it is a very dark game, which in my opinion makes it scarier. And which is kind of ironic that this whole horror franchise is one of my favorites, because I get scared maybe within the first 5 minutes. Anyway, Revelations 2 also does have some sentimental value for me. Anyway, side note, speaking of favorite characters, it seems that every time I talk about a character, I seem to call them my favorite, which really makes me think, who is not one of my favorites? Something to think about later on. Moving on, Barry first appeared in Resident Evil, the first game. He was a member of the Alpha team and went through all the mess that occurred in the Spencer Mansion. Fun fact, Barry was also in the Air Force, serving alongside with Chris Redfield. He was discharged first, and he was the one that convinced Chris to join STARS in the first place after he had been discharged for reasons unknown, which we should probably explore in a later episode, because what's up with that? So we know Barry is a caring person, but he also does have his faults, just like we do. And I don't know, it's something that the franchise really highlights a lot. I mean, for crying out loud, Chris Redfield and Leon S. Kennedy have so many faults, so many personal stuff going on, which I think it's one of the great aspects of the franchise, trying to humanize everything a bit. Back to Barry. He has always prioritized his family. We see this in the first game when he is coerced into following Wesker's orders. After all, he was threatening Barry's family. After the incident in the Spencer Mansion, he decided to send his wife, Kathy, and two daughters, Moira and Polly, up to Canada, because he understood that Raccoon City was no longer a safe place to be. I mean, looking at the actual timelines, I think what it took all but a month or two for all of it to go badly. So kudos to Barry on that. We all know his relationship with Moira is extremely strained at the beginning of Revelations 2. He did not want her to join TerraSave. And with good reason. So I believe Moira joining TerraSave was around 2011, if I'm not mistaken. So at that point, we all know that Umbrella and bioterrorism has really caused a giant mess and killed millions of people. So it's no joke. Barry has gone through a lot of it, and he doesn't want the same for Moira. Of course, Moira, being Moira, defied him in every way. And what does she do? Join TerraSave. So, in order to make sense of this high level of defiance and rebellion, we need to go back. Like, way back. Which, don't want it to seem like therapy, but we do need to revisit Moira's childhood. So, something we do see in Revelations 2 is Moira's strong aversion to guns, which is why she never, well, I can't say never because she eventually does, but at first she does not want to use guns, and instead Claire is the one that handles all of that, while Moira is in charge of the flashlight, and she does have a crowbar. Personally, I like to call Moira and Natalia glorified flashlight holders, because that's a big portion of what they do. and I do not like playing as them because of that. Anyway, back to Moira's aversion of guns. She accidentally shot Polly when they were kids because Barry neglected to properly lock up his firearms. Now, I am not going to lecture you or anyone about how guns are good or bad. It is not my place, and this is not the proper setting. Because after all, we're just here to discuss Resident Evil. I know this is only a video game, but I cannot stress enough the importance of gun safety. This incident was extremely traumatic for Moira, which is completely understandable. And it does not help that Barry only responded with anger and blamed them for touching the gun in the first place. Once again, fire safety, people. That is something we always need to keep in mind. You could also say that even in the video game world, because how many times has it not happened that you forget where the controls are and you end up firing your gun? Something that Resident Evil 4 also puts into consideration. You can accidentally shoot and kill Ashley, which makes you fail the mission. So, gun safety. Moira seems to resent him a lot and is quite vocal about how much she dislikes him. So, the beginning of Revelations 2 actually shows Moira at a Terra save event with Claire. And at that point, we know that Claire has been inactive participant within TerraSave compared to her brother joining the BSAA. So during the beginning, Moira and Claire get kidnapped by, lo and behold, another Wesker. Although unfortunately not Albert, we get Alex. Another crazy genius, great, just what we needed. I will admit though, I really like her character. Who knows? Maybe it is a Wesker thing, and I am kind of biased in that aspect because I really do like Albert. So Alex is no exception, maybe. Who knows? Although her boss fight was extremely underwhelming in my opinion, it is reminiscent of Albert's boss battle back in Resident Evil 5. Only that it does not involve volcanoes and a certain boulder punching man. Excluding Heisenberg's specific phrasing. So, enough about Albert and Alex. Our primary focus in all of this is Barry. So, Barry decided to launch a solo mission to rescue Moira once he gets the information from Claire, which is actually more complicated than the simple statement makes it seem, because it was a whole mess, and I don't even want to recount exactly, because I hate timers. So when the whole thing was on fire and exploding with Claire and Moira, let's just say video game pressure gets to me and I was panicking. So the fact that Barry went alone to go rescue Moira really speaks volumes about his characters. For starters, he does not even know if she even is alive in the first place. After all, it had been a long time, and Claire barely even made it out herself. So, granted, yes, video game, we know she's alive and whatnot, but Barry decided to go, had no idea, it had been a long time since he had seen either of them, and decides, you know what, I am going to go, she's my daughter, we're going to go see what happens. So once he gets to the island, he meets a girl, Natalia. She is a survivor of the Terra Grigia Panic, which, if you are not familiar with, then you need to refer to Revelations 1, a game centered around the BSAA and other conspiracies with the FBC. And you get to play as so many characters, including Jill Valentine and Chris Redfield. Although I really enjoyed Parker's gameplay, I don't know, maybe the whole Terra Grigia thing. So Natalia does have some special abilities thanks to Alex, who's trying to transfer her consciousness to her body. So they do have bracelets. So right off the bat, we know that Natalia is infected, but she is not turning into any monster. It's her being her, and she is able to detect if any of the monsters are nearby, which is a good ability to have. So kudos to Natalia for that, because other than that, it's very frustrating. So once Barry rescues Moira, he also takes in Natalia as well, who still has some of Alex's consciousness in her. And it is totally hinted that she may or may not turn evil, because we do see it sort of resurface towards the end of the game, but it's not something that the Burtons or even Claire seem to realize. So that should be interesting. Time for another Revelations game. Personally, I find that both Revelations and Revelations 2 are amazing games to play. And given when Revelations 2 was released, it did bring back a lot of the horror aspect that had been lost with the other main games. So there are rumors for another Revelations game, although this time they're saying that it would probably focus on Rebecca Chambers, or should I say Dr. Chambers, because she did quit all of that to go to medical school and became a vital researcher. And who knows, it might be a good collaboration, although they said with the Switch, now with the release of the new Switch version, OLED, maybe a different possibility. So, would you like to see Barry again? What do you think he is up to now? After all, it has been almost 10 years since the last time we saw him. Personally, I want to see him happy and relaxed, especially now that things are better with Moira. Let us know on Instagram at AUP Radio. That's all the time we have tonight. Thank you for joining us, my fellow resident geeks.
Thank you so much for listening to AUP Radio's 25th episode of the semester. If you'd like to hear more, you can tune in here on World Radio Paris every day, Monday through Thursday, from 9 to 10 p.m. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, or even an idea for a show that you'd like to hear us do, you can DM us on Instagram. We're at AUP Radio. This episode was produced by Nicole DeSante, Clark Marchese, and myself, your host, Kira Roddy. Music by Vicate Studios. Enjoy your night.